the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and we will open the informational hearing. And Janet, can you... Jessica, you want to come on up, too? Dugan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may recall House Bill 2214, although it seemed like a long time ago, February 2nd, the bill passed out of this committee and went to the House floor and spent some time in the Senate. The bill is actually a technical, most of it is a technical cleanup from a legislation that passed in the 2003 session, House Bill 2341, that was a major rewrite of the public contracting code. And there were a number of issues that were unresolved, but the bill was attempting, the work groups were attempting to get the bill out by March 1st, which was the effective date of the large bill from last session. And Mr. Chair, the group is here today to explain what the changes that were made in the Senate. It's up for, this is not before the committee for any action today. It's up before the committee just to, for information before it, the motion to concur or not concur is made on the House floor.
Hopefully so we can answer some questions on the floor. Jessica.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. For the record, Jessica Harris-Adamson with Associated General Contractors. Before you is a one-page document that outlines the major amendments made to House Bill 2214 in the Senate. With your indulgence, we'll walk quickly through these and then answer any questions that you might have. Here with me today are Dugan Petty with DAS and Blake Underwood with the Department of Justice, who can also answer any questions you might have. The First Amendment deals with hours of labor provisions in ORS 279B. As you recall, 279B deals with purchasing and goods. And when the rewrite was passed, the hours of labor provisions that are pretty specific in the old law, we then referenced the Fair Labor Standards Act, which didn't eliminate protection for workers but wasn't exactly what we had in the old law. Due to some concerns raised by Boley in this committee, we have reinstituted the provisions that were in the original 279 as they relate to services. At the agreement of Boley, we have not extended those back to goods because if you're purchasing a widget off of a shelf, it is impossible to try and figure out who made that widget and did those hours of labor's work out in the way they should. So for services and direct personal services contracts, those provisions will apply per the amendment made in the Senate. Energy savings performance contracts were also an issue of great concern over here and raised some big questions. We have, again, as was proposed in the original 2214, return energy savings performance contracts to the code, though as was passed in the 2003 session, we have exempted them from the competitive bidding requirements of the code. They are, however, now subject, as they were originally intended to be, to bonding requirements, prevailing wage requirements, etc. These energy savings performance contracts, the provisions in the amendments made it clear that agencies not only have the option to follow DOJ model rules, but if they so choose to adopt their own rules under which they can exempt energy savings performance contracts from the competitive bidding requirements and follow those rules, or have the option to do project-specific exemptions. So agencies, as was originally intended by the original 2214, have the ability to choose any one of those three options, and this provides some clarity. Additionally, the amendments clarify Department of Forestry exception. This is an exception they had prior to the change in 2314. There was some inconsistency. We're just clearing that up. This is not a policy change. The next three issues here, the electronic notice for the Department of Transportation, Treasury and Secretary of State, special procurements, and sole source provisions all stem from the fact that in ORS 279A.050, we made it clear, as was in the old law, that ODOT
The Secretary of State and the State Treasurer have their own procurement authority. As such, the new law wasn't clear that as it relates to providing electronic notice, special procurement procedures and sole source provisions, that they indeed had authority to do those on their own. If we had not made that clear, they would be constantly running to DASC asking for those exceptions, which is cumbersome and inefficient, and part of the reason that we cleaned up the law and gave them that authority under those provisions in the first place. So we're clearing that up. There was a misreference in the judicial review statutes related to challenges to brand name specifications. I know that's really exciting, but we cleared that up. A few bonding requirements. Because we have now allowed for a three-quote process in 279C, we changed the for ease of contract administration, changed the performance and payments bond requirements to match those, so that when you're doing a competitive quote, you don't necessarily need to provide a full performance and payment bond. And we also clarified that the Oregon University system, that is exempt largely from the public contracting code, that they can also exempt contracts or classes of contracts from bond and bid security requirements in the same way that DAS, ODOT, and local contract review boards can. And a few other provisions. We clarified the protests of judicial review for special procurements. We deleted an unused definition, one that we made but isn't used anywhere in the statute. We didn't figure we needed unnecessary definitions in there. We clarified the exemptions in ORS 279C. If you have for emergencies or other, if you have a real emergency, then you don't need to go and make a second set of findings and have a hearing and do all that. Just get out there and fix the project. And finally, we had some syntax problems in small procurement, so we decided to clear this up too. That's the scope of the amendments that the Senate made. Happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Jessica. Any questions? Don't see any. Don't see any at all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else that comments on 2214 amendments? Okay. We'll close the informational hearing. Committee Senate Bill 81 will be carried over to either Thursday or Friday. And with that, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 690. Janet, please. Anybody here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 690 does two major things. It extends the eligibility of dislocated workers for supplemental benefits beyond June 30th, 2005, and permits payment of supplemental unemployment benefits to dislocated workers whose unemployment resulted from return to service in the Oregon National Guard or military reserve forces following a change in status. Mr. Chair, and the bill does have an emergency clause. You have the Senate staff measure summary and a fiscal impact statement that was prepared in the Senate for the A. Engross bill, and you should be looking at the amended A. Engross bill.
Okay. Thank you, Janet. There isn't anyone signed up. Tamara, did you want to?
I was here to answer questions if there were any questions.
Committee have any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Tamara. I'm curious, is this going to have any impact on our previously passed bill where we're lowering the amount of trust funds or the tax rate and reducing the amount of trust funds?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. We do not anticipate that it will. The provision of the benefits to the military individuals who come back are benefits that are what are known as reimbursable benefits. So basically, because they're military claims, that amount of money will be reimbursed to the trust fund by whichever military department or whichever, and I'm probably butchering the terminology with respect to the military departments, because it'll be reimbursed either by the Oregon Military Department or the Army, Navy, whichever branch pays those benefits when an individual gets unemployed after being in service. And then the remaining amount of benefits apply to tax-paying employers, and we don't believe that the amount's a high estimate of usage. It's not been an overly used program, and we also are redoing our forecast, so at this point we don't believe that those benefits will affect the tax reduction.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions, Tamara? Thank you, Tamara. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 690? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 690 and open the work session on Senate Bill 690. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recommend that we send 690 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 690 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Gilman. Aye. Representative Folby. Aye. Representative Kelsey. Excuse. Representative Gilman. Aye. Motion carried. Place on the consent calendar?
Yes, sir. I recommend that we do place 690 on the consent
calendar. Representative Esquivel moves 690, Senate Bill 690 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar. I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 108. I have Paul Clary and Steve Delaney, please. Janet, can you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are several separate provisions of Senate Bill 108. You have an unamended bill, so that you don't need to be looking for an gross bill. The Senate vote was 28-0 on this bill. The bill clarifies the statutory definition of inactive member and modifies provisions regarding the individual account program. Requires retirees to receive a lump sum payment for smaller accounts instead of getting a monthly payment for very small amounts, and allows PERS members 55 and younger but who have 30 or more years of service to receive their individual account program benefits according to a monthly or another installment schedule. They would not have to receive them as lump sum. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. Appreciate this opportunity to be with you on a Monday morning. You know, my old job used to say, you know what follows 2 days of solid rain in Oregon? Monday morning. It's been six weekends now that we've had that here in the valley, but it's something that that we've needed, although it's starting to get a little old. I'm going to give our introductory remarks once on these five bills, and then Steve can go into the detail on them as they come up, unless you want to take them all at once. But what we've got in front of you are five PERS board-sponsored bills. You might recall that in the 2003 reform package, the legislature changed the membership of the board from, I believe, 12 members to five, with three of them from the private sector. Along with that change came direction to establish a legislative advisory committee. And that committee is currently composed of 14 members, seven employer, and seven member group stakeholders, and that's shown in our testimony, the current membership, and I notice that several of those committee members are here today. We worked with that committee on the five PERS board-sponsored bills that you're scheduled to take up this morning. All our housekeeping measures that received the near-unanimous support of the committee and have since received similar near-unanimous support of the Senate. I think all of these bills reflect something that we try to do at PERS, and that is always reserve the right to get smarter. And we have gotten smarter in our administration of both the legacy Tier 1, Tier 2 program, as well as the new Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, also known as OPSERP, both individually as well as how they interact between those components within our overall system. And with those introductory remarks, Mr. Chair, I'd ask Steve Delaney to go into the particular bills.
Thank you, Paul. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director at PERS. Senate Bill 108 in particular, which is one we've started the hearing on, is really a housekeeping bill pertaining to interactions between the new plan, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, and the prior existing plans that are often known as PERS Tier 1 and Tier 2. Because of the provisions of what's called break in service, where a person, if they're gone for more than 6 months, can move from PERS Tier 1, Tier 2 into the newer plan, there are occasions when members have both sets of rules and regulations, as it were, applying to their accounts. And so this bill is simply meant to make those work smoothly together. You'll see in the testimony that's been provided to you, starting on page 2, that there are four basic components to Senate Bill 108. First off, it clarifies the definition of inactive member. The newer plan did not include that definition, so we needed to define when a person actually is no longer accruing PERS benefits. It clarifies the definition of qualifying position. The two different plans had slightly different terminologies being used for qualifying position within PERS Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP, and that makes sure that they're consistent, assisting us in our administration of the plan. It modifies the individual account program so that if an account is very small, and in these beginning years of the program, we're going to have some very small accounts as people start to retire and go out. We didn't want to have occasions where a person might only have a few hundred dollars in their account and PERS would be required to pay that to them over a period of 20 years, you know, having a check for $5 a month, as it were, going out to the individual with all the administrative costs that would incur. So this would allow the PERS board to set a minimum amount that has to be in the account to pay it out in a monthly annuity, or not annuity rather, but benefit. And finally, number four, because you again have these interactions between the two plans, you could have occasion where a Tier 1, Tier 2 member is ready to retire at 30 and out, but also has an individual account plan, program account, and that program account can only be paid out at 55. But if you have a Tier 1, Tier 2 member who has worked 30 years and is ready to retire at 52, you have a three-year gap. Do they have to take it in a lump sum? This would tell the board, no, you can actually begin to pay that account out to them at the time they're ready to retire. That's the background to 108. Happy to answer questions on that. And Chair Brown, whichever other bills you may want to hear at this point.
So the modified individual account program, then you would establish a minimum amount, and then any amount under that would be paid in a lump sum. Is that what it's done?
That is correct.
Okay. Any questions? Don't see any on 108 anyway. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 108? Let's see. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 108 and open a work session on Senate Bill 108. Representative Escobar.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 108 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 108 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitt. Excused.
Representative
Shockley. Excused.
Representative Still.
Aye.
Representative
Escobar. Aye. Chair Brown. Aye. Motion carries. Representative Escobar. On the consent calendar?
Do you think we can do that?
Sure.
Yeah, we should be able to. I recommend that we put Senate Bill 108 on the consent calendar, Mr. Chair.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 108 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 109. Janet? Maybe just.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 109, I think they could probably go ahead with their testimony.
Okay.
You have a Senate staff measure summary, no fiscal impact, one no vote in the Senate. And, Mr. Chair, We may be waiting to hear from council about the blank on page 2 on this bill. So, thank
you. Okay, Steve.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again for the record, Steve Delaney with PERS. 109 deals with a earnings rate that the PERS board is to pay on estimated earnings, estimated benefits. What happens is the legislature has allowed PERS up to 92 days to make payment to a member, but if for some reason or another we cannot actually get that benefit out within the 92 days, we pay them an estimated benefit. That benefit then, when we get a final benefit calculated, they're owed earnings on the difference between what their estimated might have been and what their actual turns out to be. The current statute says the board will pay the rate that has been directed for that particular member to them. With time and with the modifications of the PERS plan, there are more than one rate in existence. And so Senate Bill 109 is simply telling the board that they have rulemaking authority to determine the rates to be distributed to these individuals when they're receiving an estimated benefit. To the issue that Janet Edkins has mentioned, the fact that in Section 2 there is a blank, that was put in there by Legislative Council because of being unsure when the board would have the rule in effect. So this bill will become effective upon passage. It has an emergency clause. Section 2, sub 1 was left blank as to, but when does the board think they'd actually have their rule in place? We're comfortable with the January 1, 2006 date there, that we'd have a rule in place by that point.
January 1, 2006. Yeah, okay. Is there any questions of Steve or Paul? I don't see anyone. Was there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 109? And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 109 and open a work session on Senate Bill 109. We need a conceptual amendment to start with, Janet. Cool.
Yeah. And that was on the rule?
On the back side there. We need to fill that blank in there with January 1. The chair would entertain a motion to make a conceptual amendment inserting January 1 in the blank on line 14 on page 2.
Oh, so moved.
Representative moves. Escobel moves. We amend the date January 1 and to the blank on line 14 on page 2 to Senate Bill 109. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 109 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 109 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, you call the roll, please.
Representative
Paul. Aye.
Excuse.
Representative
Shields. Aye. Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Hill. Aye. Motion carries. Representative Escobar.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 109 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Escobar moves that Senate Bill 109 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Ordered. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 54. Steve, you want to go ahead and tell us what it's all about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Steve Delaney with PERS. The background of this has to deal with when a member can change their option, their benefit. When a member retires from PERS, there are many benefit options out there, many different methods in which you can obtain your benefit. One of them includes an insurance policy should your spouse die before you or should you divorce while retired. And what this benefit option says is that if you take a lower benefit now and your spouse dies or divorces you during retirement, you will, what we call pop up, you will pop up to the higher basic benefit. The current statute says that if that occurs, the trigger event that pops you up to the higher benefit is when you get around to telling PERS it occurred, the death or the divorce. What often happens is that because of the trauma of the event, especially with regard to death, it may take members several years to get around to telling PERS that this event has occurred, and during that time they've missed out on a higher benefit that was always their benefit. They had taken a lower benefit from the beginning in order to access this pop-up. They've missed out because of that. This bill would say PERS will pay the benefit when the event occurred. So it may take us several years before the member actually tells PERS that's occurred, but we will pay them a retro back to the date in which the trigger event occurred. It does not have a fiscal because the actuary has always assumed that the member was going to be telling us when the event actually occurred. And so this simply takes care of that issue for the member.
Okay, any questions? Don't see any. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 54 and open a work session on Senate Bill 54. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 54 to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 54 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, you call the roll.
Representative Kitts.
Excuse.
Representative
Chaffler. Excused.
Representative
Shields. Aye.
Representative Gilman. Excused. Representative Colby.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Consent calendar. Sure. Representative Colby moves that Senate Bill 54 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's ordered. I'm going to go to Senate Bill. Mark off my list. I'll go to Senate Bill 110. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Steve Delaney for PERS. Two minor corrections here with this bill. The first portion of the bill takes care of the issue of a beneficiary designation. Oftentimes what happens is we get unusual stories from members and it reveals to us a weakness in the statute. This is one of those types of scenarios. We had a member who had filed a beneficiary designation for spouse number one, separated from PERS, withdrew their money, and while separated, divorced wife number one, married wife number two, returned to PERS employment, did not file a new designation of beneficiary, and deceased. Well, there's this little known rule in statute that says when you withdraw from PERS, everything's canceled except for that prior designation of beneficiary. That restores when you return to work. So in this scenario, this member died, PERS had no choice but to pay wife number one all of the benefits. This bill says, no, when you leave PERS, your beneficiary designation is canceled. You have to file a new one when you return to employment. The other item that this takes care of, this bill also clarifies that an alternate payee's account is the property of the alternate payee. We occasionally have events where a member will divorce, their account is split, and the alternate payee dies. And the member calls us up and says, I want all that money now. The alternate payee died. I want it back. That's not the case. It does belong to the payee's estate unless the divorce decree is said otherwise. This will simply make it very clear in statutes. There's less question in the members' minds when they're giving the PERS a call about this issue.
I bet the first issue was a real cat and dog fight then, wasn't it?
It was a very
unhappy second wife. Real unhappy.
Is there any questions, Steve? Representative Holby.
Just one. Do you know how many first wives as opposed to second wives are in the PERS system?
Representative Brown and Representative Holby, no, I do not. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
We have a conflict amendment, Janet.
Chair, yeah. I did want to ask. Does this affect people that have terminated their PERS already prior to the effective date?
I believe, let me just double check here, Janet. I believe what they did is they only applied it moving forward.
Well, okay. The staff member summary, that's why I had underlined it, and so that's why I remembered to ask. It applies to all PERS members, whether membership in PERS is terminated on or after the effective date, but not prior to.
That's right. Unless a member is not interested. It's the entire, it is everyone, before, on, or after, so it is all of those. So, and the reason we were comfortable with that is there is existing statute elsewhere, ORS 390, that provides for a process for paying out a benefit if there is no designation beneficiary filed at all. So that pays spouse first, current spouse first, and then gives an alternative listing of beneficiaries. So we were comfortable with canceling this provision altogether, including those that have already withdrawn and terminated.
Okay, thank you. Janet, you want to explain to us what the dash two?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, for new members, this might be the first time they've seen it on Senate bills, second chamber bills. This occurs if you're in the Senate to House bills. We make a call before the bill comes to committee and to council and say we're doing a conflicts check. Because if two bills in the process amend the same section of statute, sometimes they can just blend them together, but they have to check in case they conflict. And in this case, council told us Friday that Senate Bill 110 did conflict with Senate Bill 108, one of the other bills this morning. So yeah, that, and then they prepare a conflict amendment, and it's adopted, needs to be adopted just like any other amendment, and it will require it going back to the Senate for concurrence as well. So this, as you see, proposed amendments to resolve conflicts. So this is an amendment to Senate Bill 110 that if Senate Bill 108 becomes law, then Section 3 of this Act is repealed. Now, of this 110 Act is repealed. And in this case, they both amended and made clarifications to a certain to ORS 238-095. I guess council thought it was better in Senate Bill 108, so they're going to repeal the changes that are in Senate Bill 110. It doesn't repeal the statute itself. It repeals the changes to the statute that are in Senate Bill 110. So, does that make sense?
Same thing.
So, just better. Thank you, Janet.
Do we have to repeat that, Mr. Chair?
Only if we carry the bill.
Not on Monday morning.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 110 and open work session on Senate Bill 110. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 110.
Representative Esquivel moves we adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 110. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Well done. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 110 to the House floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 110 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Shoffler.
Excuse.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Hillman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Pitts.
Chair
Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Okay. Consent calendar, I think. Or you want to? Nah, we'll let. all right. Representative Esquivel will. And there might be some ex wives that want an explanation.
Exactly.
Representative Esquivel will carry the bill on the floor for us. The chair would ask that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Gilman to vote on Senate Bill 54. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Gilman, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Gilman votes aye on Senate Bill 54.
Do you have any objection to being placed on the consent calendar?
Do you have any objection to it being placed on the consent calendar?
I do not.
Let's see. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 111. And
question.
Thank you, Steve.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, Steve Delaney from PERS. Senate Bill 111 is a clarification as to what the legislature has created in the 2003 session with regard to PERS reform. The question was, were there multiple plans or was there a single plan? This bill clarifies for all purposes, both Internal Revenue Service as well as our administrative purposes, that there is a single plan, the PERS plan, with component parts. The PERS Tier 1 is a component part, PERS Tier 2, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan pension portion, as well as the individual count program. The reason that's important is that a number of public employers, including the state of Oregon, have paid, made bond, or created bond, issued bonds, excuse me, and paid those funds into PERS to pay down their unfunded actuarial liability. There is the possibility in coming years that if the bond monies were limited only to Tier 1 and Tier 2, that all the liabilities could be paid off and you'd have monies in essence stuck there, not doing any good for the employer. This bill makes it clear that it's one plan and the PERS can shift assets to where needed to cover the liabilities where they may be occurring within the component programs.
Okay. Is there any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Bill Linden, please. Does anyone have the dash A3 amendments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For your record, Bill Linden, representing the Circuit Court Judges Association and the Appellate Court Judges Association. And I wanted to spend a little time explaining to you the dash A3 amendments. I would note, first of all, there's a couple pieces of these amendments that don't relate to the judge plan. One is the change in the emergency clause language that was originally in the bill. That's being deleted, and this bill would, if passed by both chambers, would be effective, I believe, on the 91st day after adjournment. And then there was another amendment made to delete the word plan and insert the word program. Again, that's unrelated to the judicial retirement amendments that are also included in the A3s. It's important to understand that the judge's retirement system in the Oregon statutes is completely different than the regular PERS retirement system. It's a true defined benefit, defined contribution plan. Judges are the only category of state officer or employee who have statutory caps on the benefits that they can accrue upon retirement. Right now they have two options. We call them Plan A and Plan B. Under Plan A, you can retire at 65 years of age with a 65% cap related to final average salary. Under Plan B, judges can retire at age 60 with a 75% cap on final average salary in terms of benefits. However, the Plan B judges are required to give 35 days a year of free judicial service upon assignment by the Chief Justice for a five-year period. So it's 35 days for 5 years. That's in exchange for the higher retirement benefit under the Plan B program. That was put in place in the mid-90s. It was put in place as a means of supplementing judicial resource needs without adding new judgeships. And frankly, most of our judges these days do retire under Plan B. We found that we had two very much housekeeping issues and then two more substantive issues that we needed to address related to the judge's plan. And I should also mention that under the judge's plan, they've never had the option, for example, of retiring under money match, which was one of the retirement options that was a very viable option prior to the 2003 legislation that that made many significant changes in the PERS system. Again, the judge's plan is, it is what it is. You have a retirement accrual rate every year, you have a statutory cap, and then you have the choice between the Plan A, Plan B. What we have done in these amendments is, first, and this was in response to an ambiguity that had existed for quite some time in the statute that we had discussed with PERS and we agreed with them. This amendment clarifies that judges' benefits are calculated using both contributions and earnings. That's how they've always been calculated, but there was a statutory ambiguity about that. So in three different parts of these amendments, section 2 in section 26 and 1 in section 28, you'll see that the word "and earnings" is included. Again, that's just simply clarifying what the status quo is and always has been. So contributions and earnings are used to calculate judge benefits just like they're used to calculate benefits for any PERS member. Secondly, in the 2003 legislation, there was some language included that cast some doubt on whether judges could participate in the variable account. And judges have always been able to participate in the variable account. The 2003 legislation was designed not to impact judge retirement in any way, shape, or form, and that was in recognition of the fact that they had a separate system from the regular PERS system. So that change that makes it clear that the participation in the variable account continues is in section 30 of the bill on page 8, lines 27 to 30. The two other changes, well, actually there's three. Judges right now, occasionally, and it doesn't happen very often, there are judges who start their public service at a young enough age where they will hit the statutory cap of 75% before they reach age 60. And we've had several instances in the past decade where that's occurred. And what you end up having is a judge continuing to have to serve and not accumulating one additional retirement benefit for the extra years. I believe the youngest anyone ever hit that age was age 57. And that was a judge in Portland who, again, had started his judicial service at a fairly young age. In Section 26 of these amendments, there's a provision that allows judges, when they've hit that cap and they're not yet at age 60, to choose to retire at age 58. We had some discussions internally, should it be 55, 56? We thought 58 was a good number to settle on. We don't believe it's going to impact many judges in the future, but it would, again, take them out of the situation of having to continue to provide full-time service and accumulate absolutely no additional retirement benefit. The other change, and this is in Section 26, aligns the statute with judges' actual terms of office. Judges are elected for six-year terms. Currently, the statute provides that the base accrual rate, the annual accrual rate of 3.75%, is effective for the first 16 years. And that is just a historical anomaly. It's been around forever. 16 years was first put in statute years ago when the Judicial Retirement Fund, which is a separate fund from what we have today, was being constructed to provide a 50% benefit after 16 years of service. We've been trying, for this will be the second session, to align that accrual rate with their actual terms of office. So this amendment would provide that the 3.75% would apply for 18 years. That's three full terms. And all of our career judges are serving at least three full terms, as opposed to 16 years, which doesn't line up with that. And then lastly, Section 27 provides that all of these changes are prospective only. There's no retroactive application, and that was intended. We don't want to go back in time and try and provide any additional break or benefit to anyone. In terms of the fiscal impact, there's no fiscal impact in 2005-2007. The actuary in their letter indicated that in setting rates for 2007-2009, that, you know, this will be a part of their rate-setting calculation, but we don't know exactly what that will result in. Judges, as you may imagine, it's a small group of people. There's a separate rate set for them. Their rate has fluctuated over the years. It's gone from, you know, below the regular PERS rate to where it is today, which is above the regular PERS rate. But until the actuary does the rate setting for 07-09, it's very difficult to estimate exactly what, if any, impact this will have. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would be happy to respond to any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions? The fiscal for 07-09 comes in because of the change from 16 to 18 years?
In the actuary's letter, it's unclear how much is attributable to, might be attributable to that or to the 58-year retirement option. But both of those will be recalculated in the rate setting process for 07-09, and we'll see what that number actually comes in at.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Is there, Steve or Paul, do you have any comments you'd like to make on it?
Thank you, Chair Brown. Members of the committee, again, Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. Of course, setting the benefit level is a legislative prerogative, and that's not something that the board gets involved in, so we're neutral on that. We can administer these changes, and with that, I guess, Steve, did you have anything else that you might want to add? I think the estimate was about a $275,000 increase in UAL.
$275,000. Janet?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office put a $275,000. They said it would probably be higher than that, but that's at least what it was. And the letter that we just distributed from Kingsley, the email from Bill Linden, had a $285,000.
Right.
And nothing again, nothing next biennium.
Right. And of course, what we'd be doing is we'd be doing the system valuation as of December 31st, 2005, and incorporate in that the experience for the new plan, the OPSERP plan that new judges are going into. And so it's difficult right now to give real refined estimates, but certainly by 2007, 2009, we will have one.
Thank you, Paul.
And Mr. Chair, since it just affects judges, there's no effect on any other employers, but it would be a general fund. It's general fund.
Impact, and possibly in 2007-2009. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 111 or the amendments to it? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 111 and open the work session on Senate Bill 111.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman.
I move the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 111.
Representative Gilman moves the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 111. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. Representative Gilman.
I move Senate Bill 111 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilman moves Senate Bill 111 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Excuse.
Representative
Hoffler. Excuse.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
I'll do it.
Okay, Representative Gilman will carry this, the bill on the floor for us. Thank you, Representative.
That's why I took the other one. It was easier.
Janet, is there...
You want to talk about the evening meeting?
Oh, yeah. Tell us about our evening meetings.
Our evening meeting?
Tomorrow evening, 5:30.
After House floor session.
It may not take longer than an hour, 5:30.
Depends on what you talk.
And how early we get here.
Order, sir.
Depends on if kids.
And then also on Thursday.
Okay, so it's Monday and Tuesday and Thursday?
Yes.
And Wednesday's at 8.
And Wednesday is at 8 o'clock in the morning. Anything else?
Okay.
In other words, it's 5 days this week.
An evening meeting?
We're adjourned.
Didn't we do something on overtime?